Judges chapter 6. We're going Old Testament. Judges chapter 6. You ever considered the process of the making of a man or a woman of God? It's intriguing to me that great men and women of God are never made in a moment. Not one of us is born one. In fact, we start with a sin nature. It's given to us, according to Scripture, by our Father. And because of it, we commit sin. David is praying a prayer in the 51st Psalm, a prayer of repentance for the sin that he committed with Bathsheba. And he says this. And it's incredible theology. He says, "Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." I'm a sinner by conception. Then he's confessing his sin, and he says, "I acknowledge my transgressions. My sin is ever before me. Against thee only have I sinned." Not only am I a sinner by conception, I'm a sinner by choice. The making of a man or a woman of God could not start more humbly than the fact that we are sinners in conception and by choice. So how then can a man or a woman of God be fashioned from such a start as this? It can happen because of a forgiving and because of a gracious and because of a patient and because of a merciful and thankfully because of a long-suffering God. And such is the story of Job. What am I talking about? Job's another book, the book of Judges. We're talking about Gideon. Somebody study your sermon notes so you know what you're preaching. Gideon. Judges chapter 6, I'll begin reading in verse 1. "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds. And so it was when Israel had sown," that's sow the harvest, sow and it begins to grow and it's coming in now, it's harvest time, "that the Midianites came up and the Amalekites and the children of the east, even they came up against them. And they encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth till thou come unto Gaza and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor ass. For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude. For both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet unto the children of Israel, which said unto them," now this is not a message they really want to hear, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you forth out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all that oppressed you and drave them out from before you and gave you their land. And I said unto you, I am the Lord your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell, but ye have not obeyed my voice." Now let's switch scenes. The prophet has come and he's delivered a message to the children of Israel. "The reason that you are in bondage is because you have chosen other gods other than me." Now we're going to switch scenes and we're going to go to a little place behind a wine press. We're going to meet in verse 11, Gideon. "And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak tree, which was in Ophrah," not Oprah, Ophrah, "that pertained unto Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." That's an amazing start. Gideon, we've just met. The children of Israel have done it again. In fact, I'll begin by telling you it's the same old story. That's what the children of Israel are in, this devastating cycle of sin and servitude and submission to the enemies and the pagan nations that surrounded them. We read it back there in verse 1. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hands of Midian 7 years. It simply states, because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds. Deborah, the preceding prophetess, has passed on. The children of Israel have again fallen back into sin. They are crying out unto God because of the oppression of the Midianites. That's what we read in verse 6. They were greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. In essence, help us. We're impoverished. We are oppressed. We're living quite literally like animals in caves and dens and strongholds. I would imagine that at this point, national pride was pretty low for the nation of Israel. You see, Midianites were different than a lot of the other oppressors that we read of in the book of Judges, because what the Midianites would do is they would kind of go home, and when the time for harvest came in the land of Israel, the Midianites would just come with their camels and come with their cattle and come with their tents, and they would just stay there and they would wipe out the harvest for the nation of Israel. They would literally leave them no sustenance. They would feed their cattle, they would feed their camels, they would take everything for themselves, and they would go away. I would imagine that national pride's not really high at this point. In fact, if you need to understand the simple analogy of what is happening here, is the Midianites are the big schoolyard bully, and the nation of Israel is the little kid whose lunch and milk and money are taken every time that it's time to eat. The Midianites would come in and they would wipe out all of the harvest. They would take whatever they wanted and they would pass on back into the land and the children of Israel. The mighty nation of Israel, God's chosen people, are at this moment in time living like animals up in caves and dens in the rocks. Sleeping in those dark, dank places, only coming out to do what they needed to do during the daylight hours and under these incredible circumstances. Gideon has grown up to some degree. He's become a little bit resourceful, and yet I can sense that he's a bit of an angry man. Same old story for Israel. We've sinned, we've chosen to serve other gods, we've been delivered into the hands of the Midianites, and now we've been serving them for 7 years. We are greatly impoverished, we are terribly oppressed. You wonder aloud, when will they learn? And it's the same question that exists for us. How often do we have to repeat the cycle of sin? How often do we have to deal with the persecution and the consequences that coincide our fleshly decisions? When will we learn we're carnal just like they were? It's here that we see an unexpected calling. I love how the angel of the Lord speaks. You can see it in verse 11. There came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak tree which was in Ophrah. Pertained unto Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress. Why was he threshing wheat by the winepress? Well, we're given that he's doing it to hide it from the Midianites. Apparently, they'd been able to gather some meager sum of substance to live and exist on. I would like to go into this scene just a little bit, and I wonder, how long did the angel of the Lord sit there under the oak tree? I wonder how long he sat there under the oak tree and watched Gideon threshing wheat by the winepress, and he's intentionally hiding while he's threshing the wheat by the winepress. And I like to imagine, I can't be dogmatic about it, but I like to imagine that Gideon was a little bit like me. You say a mighty man of valor? No, I mean the part about hiding and threshing wheat from the Midianites and this. I like to think that he was grumbling a little bit while he did it. I hate my life. I am so sick of wheat being ground into little cakes that I have to eat. If I have to sleep another night in that cave with that snorer, I am going to die. I don't want to go back into that dark hole. I'm tired of being oppressed by the Midianites. And here the angel of the Lord is sitting under the oak tree. I like to imagine it because the story lends to that just a little bit. Because the angel of the Lord sitting under the oak tree, Gideon's hiding and he's threshing wheat. And in verse 12, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him, makes himself known, and says unto him, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." Do you see anything that resembles valor in threshing wheat by the winepress hiding out? No. And we're going to get back to that in just a second. He's hiding. What it indicates to me is, like everybody else, he certainly does not seem to be expecting rescue. Indicated a little bit is that he doesn't know who the angel of the Lord is. We do, because we have hindsight here. The Lord is with thee. Hey, right here. A theophany. God in the Old Testament. Here it is. The angel of the Lord is there. Now, I love this. And he says, "The Lord is with thee." And here's where me and Gideon have a lot in common. It shows up in verse 13. He begins to complain in frustration. Me. Verse 13, Gideon says, "Oh, my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? Where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." In other words, he's saying, where is God? Where are all of God's miracles? He's abandoned us. Shh, Gideon. He's right there. Ease up. That's why I like to think he was grumbling while he was threshing wheat by the winepress hiding. He's threshing wheat by the winepress grumbling. The angel of the Lord makes himself known and appears unto Gideon and says, "The Lord be with thee, thou mighty man of valor." That seems so out of place. It seems so ill-suited. Gideon begins to complain in frustration to the angel of the Lord. Where is God? We've heard stories. Oh, he's the deliverer. He delivered us from Egypt. Our fathers have told us that. But if that's true, why has all of this befallen us? Why are we in bondage to the Midianites? Verse 14. "And the Lord looked upon him and said, go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee?" How many of you have ever complained about a situation? You don't have to raise your hand. You've complained about a situation, and then somebody said, "Okay, if you want the situation fixed, I'm giving you the assignment to fix the situation." There's an awful lot of bluster in Gideon. Where is God? We've heard stories from our fathers that he delivered them from Egypt. But if that's the truth, where then are all of his miracles? Why are we in bondage to the Midianites? God has abandoned us. Oh, Gideon, go in this thy might that you are exercising right now in fury and rage, and deliver the children of Israel. Problem seen, assignment given. And you say, so Gideon just rounds the corner and he's like, all right, I'll do it. No, look at verse 15. "And he said unto him, oh, my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." I got an awful lot to complain about. Okay, here's how you can fix it, and you're the person to fix it. Oh, no, not me. I'll just hide here and complain. It's just better. That's exactly how we are. It's human nature. I can point out the problem. I can complain about its existence. But I'm not going to do anything about it. Here's where God amazes me. Here's where we begin to see the making of a man of God from a really humble origin. God says to him, "Thou mighty man of valor." Now, he's just said of himself, "My family's poor. I'm the least in my father's house. You've caught me hiding by the winepress, threshing wheat. And you call me a mighty man of valor." Can we just pause for a second and understand that God sees where Gideon can go and what Gideon can become and not what Gideon is at that moment? Aren't you thankful that God can see beyond your current limitations? Aren't you glad that God, by His long-suffering and His patience and His mercy and His kindness and His power, can see what we can become and where we can go, not exactly where we are at that moment? Something else intrigues me. Gideon begins to throw out some excuses and some reasoning. My family is poor. Look at me. I have nothing. I'm over here. I'm going back to a cave. I'm the least of my father's house. I mean, I offer you nothing. And it intrigues me that as we read down through, we get to verse 16, and here's what he says. And the Lord said unto him, surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. And here's what we want. Here's our expectations. My family's poor. I'm the least of all my family. Here's what we want from God. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give your family excessive wealth, okay? And then I'm going to give you incredible physical prowess and strength. And then you will be ready. Human nature will give those two reasons for why we can't. If God met those two reasons for why we couldn't, we would come up with two more. Do you remember Moses at the burning bush? I can't. Why? Well, I don't talk well. Well, here. I don't know what to say. Hey, look at me. I'm out here in the middle of nowhere. I'm talking to a bush. I mean, what do I offer you? Excuse after excuse after excuse. Do you recognize that in this passage, God does not address every one of Gideon's concerns? He simply offers up to him, I will be with you. In your weakness, I will be with you. In what you deem that you lack, it's all covered by the fact that I will be with you. God is raising up a rescuer for the nation of Israel. He's starting from a very humble origin. Same old story, a really unexpected calling, as we see Gideon called and tasked with the assignment to do the delivering. And Gideon's going to stick his toe in the water a little bit. Fear still present. Look down at verse 25 of chapter 6. God does not drag his feet, by the way. Came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, here's an assignment. Let's see what you got, Gideon. Take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old. I mean, he makes it clear which one. Throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath. And cut down the grove that's by it. That grove is... it's not just a grove of trees like we would think of. It's pagan imagery. It's very sensual, very immoral worship around that grove. That's by it. Cut those things down. Then build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place. Take the second bullock, offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which thou shalt cut down. Take those idols that you cut down. That's your wood for your sacrifice. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. All right, Gideon, you man, you. Keep reading. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, he could not do it by day. He did it by night. Now, I'm saying he's still brave, right? But we must acknowledge that fear is still present. Gideon, thou mighty man of valor, you are going to save Israel. Go in this thy might and thou shalt save Israel. You'll wipe out Midian as one man. I can't. My family is poor. I'm the least of my family. Surely I will be with you. That same night, I imagine that Gideon is resting in the cave, or he's laying in the cave thinking about the day that he had just spent. That same night, the angel of the Lord comes and gives him explicit instructions. You know how your dad has built an altar to Baal and has the grove, how it's the epicenter of paganism right here? Here's what I want you to do, Gideon. Go out there, cut the grove down, knock over the altar to Baal, take the wood from the grove that you cut down, offer up your dad's second bullock. Offer it up to me. Build an altar to me and do this right now. If perhaps we could wait till it was dark, no one was around to see who did it, I'll do it. If you need me to do this in the middle of the day, I kind of fear the men of the city. Now, he's moving, right? Yet fear is still present. I love the fact, even after God said to him, peace be unto thee, fear not. Listen to the words of verse 23. Fear not, this is pretty strong, thou shalt not die. That's pretty straight. Okay, Gideon, I sense that you are nervous. I know that you are full of fear and doubt. Fear not. You're not going to die. Go down and cut down the grove. Wipe out the idol. Offer up your dad's second bullock to me. Use the grove as wood. I'm in, but I have some conditions. This is how human nature works. It's still obedient, but a little bit of fear. I think that God is beginning to communicate just as the prophet came and preached. The real problem, Israel, is not the Midianites. The real problem is the false gods that you are serving. Let me first give you a prophet who will tell you that. Let me then give you an object lesson. Cut down the groves, wipe out the altars to Baal, and return to worshiping me. I read this and I thought it was great. Faith moves forward even in fear. God does not supernaturally remove all the fear. Faith is not demonstrated in fearlessness, but in obedience in spite of the fear. Gideon was still uncertain, but he was obedient even with the presence of fear. Sometimes we imagine the only time we can actually take a step in God's will is when everything is settled and we have complete peace and all of the fear is removed. Sometimes faith moves forward when things are uncertain, and faith moves forward even when fear is present. That's why I am careful when people say things like, I feel peace about this. Sometimes you do obedience to God and you don't necessarily experience peace. I'm thinking Gideon, he was obedient. But he was moving at night because he was still somewhat uncertain. It's his uncertain heart. Gideon is known to even the fringe Bible student for his little experiment with God. It begins in verse 17. He's talking and he's got this pattern. He establishes it early. He said unto him, if, that's a big time word. If now I have found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me. Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee and bring forth my present and set it before thee. And he's talking to the angel of the Lord. Angel of the Lord says, I'll tarry here. I'm going to wait here till you come back. Gideon went in. He made ready a kid. That's the goat. Unleavened cakes of an ephah of flour. The flesh he put in a basket. And he put the broth in a pot. Brought it out unto him under the oak, back to the angel of the Lord. And the angel of God said unto him, take the flesh and the unleavened cakes and lay them upon this rock and pour out the broth. Gideon did it. The angel of the Lord then took the staff that he's clearly holding in his hand, touched the flesh and the unleavened cake, and whoosh, fire came up out of the rock, consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Now, I don't know about you. I get it at that point in time. You're not from around here. Okay, you just put your staff on the rock, fire came up out of the rock, consumed everything, and then I looked up from the rock and you were gone. Okay, that's going to settle a lot of doubts in my heart. It's not going to eliminate all of them. It's going to settle some doubts in my heart. But there's this uncertain pattern in Gideon, and it says he perceived that he was an angel of the Lord. But it's not the end of Gideon's uncertainty. As the stakes are raised, so are the doubts. In verse 33, all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. Battle lines are now being drawn. It's time for harvest. Here they come back. They're assembling in the valley. They're getting ready. There are all of their camels. There is all of their cattle. There's all of the tents and all of those people. They're back. Just like the tax man, here they come. They're going to clean us out and move on and show up again next year. And Gideon takes the lead. Verse 34, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon and he blew a trumpet and Abiezer was gathered after him. He's fearless now, right? Doubts are all gone. No more concern. Verse 36, Gideon said unto God, hold on now. Now listen, I was there when you burnt the stuff up on the rock and disappeared. I have sensed the Spirit of the Lord on me. But if you really mean that you're going to save Israel by my hand, here's the deal. I'm going to take a fleece of wool in the floor. If the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth beside, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said. I have some more conditions on you, God. My heart is still uncertain. Twice over, Gideon acknowledges that God has said it. Twice over, he acknowledges that God has said it, but he's going with his gut over God's direction. That's a big problem. He's choosing instinct over obedience to God. That's a weakness. It's amazing to me that God doesn't just cast him off that moment to the side as he keeps pressing for more and more. Because when we arrive at verse 39, you can hear him almost pleading. And Gideon said unto God, "Let not thine anger be hot against me, and I will speak but this once. Let me prove, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece." Gideon, it ain't this once. "Let it now be dry only upon the fleece, and upon all the ground let there be dew." Three signs Gideon wants. Three patient responses from God. You understand that there are times where you are going to be uncertain, but our uncertainty does not remove our obligation to obey God's command and direction. We're talking about God molding and making a man, a woman of His to fulfill and to serve in a role. And you start in such a humble place as a sinner's birth and a sinner by choice. And we look at Gideon, an unexpected calling to this hidden man whose family was poor, the least. But God says, "I see where you can go, and I want you to know I'll be with you. I know that you have doubts, and I see that your heart is uncertain. And because I'm patient, and because I'm long-suffering and merciful, I'll work with you." And God hatches an unbelievable plan. One time in Scripture, one time, you want God's plan to make sense, human sense, and it just doesn't work. You guys are going to go take out Jericho. All right, here's what you're going to do. You're going to walk around it. And then kick it. No. A few trumpets are involved. A little bit of shouting. Why are God's plans always this way? "Hey, Moses, we're going to get right to the edge of the Red Sea. Armies of Egypt are going to come. They're going to seek to wipe you out. It's good. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to part the Red Sea. You're going to walk through to the other side, and I'm going to drown the Egyptians." Sound like a plan? Not like one I've ever considered, but a plan nonetheless. "Hey, disciples, why don't you get in the boat and go to the other side? It's good. It's all good. You'll love it." Storm. How's he going to rescue? Here he comes walking across. It just never makes human sense. Here's God's unbelievable plan. Here we dive in now. God knows the heart of man. He sees an issue that's going to arise. Verse 2 of chapter 7, "The Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands." Why? Well, Israel will vaunt themselves against me, and they will say, "Mine own hand hath saved me." How many of you are great at math? We got like two people that are great at math. So we're cooked if we ever have to solve a math crisis. All right, here's what God said. "I'm taking a look at your army, Gideon. You have too many people. Too many people. If you go down and Midian is defeated, even by my hand, the Israelites are going to be full of pride, and they're going to imagine that they did it." So I think to myself, okay, well, how many did they have? They had 32,000. Well, that is a lot. But then I think to myself, the Midianite army had about 135,000. It's already terribly unfair. This screams at me this. How pride-filled is the human heart? That at 32,000 against 135,000, we'll still be like, "Well, I kind of worked that one out, didn't I?" It's God sees and knows the human condition so well that even when it's 135,000 versus 32,000, it's just too many. So God says, "Here's the deal. I want you to just ask, is anybody afraid to fight?" Well, all right, go home. Go home to mom. 22,000 of them dead. God says, "That's still too many." God, who's doing the math here? You look down there, their camels are like the sand of the seashore, innumerable. So many heads, they're like grasshoppers down there. We got 10,000 left. I got another plan. Go down and let's get a drink of water. Take them down. Get them a drink of water. Everybody that bends down and laps like a dog, I want you to put on one side. And everybody that scoops the water and drinks it up, I want you to put them on the other side. Now listen, Gideon does not know exactly what God is doing at this point. Everybody go down and get a drink. Now if I'm Gideon, I'm watching this and I'm beginning to divide 9,700 to one side and 300 to the other. And I'm literally negotiating with God. At the very least, give me the 97. I see what you're doing here, I want the 9700. We've trimmed her way down. 9700. We get it. It is not us. It is all you. And God says, hey, I want you to take the 300. All right. Are you going to drop like down a cool laser type weapon? I think he was thinking about laser type weapons. A cool laser type weapon from heaven so that we can just wipe the Midianites out. Do you have something like that? It's better. I can't wait. Why don't you take some lanterns? Yeah. Flamethrowers. Cool. I like it. Flamethrowers. Why don't you take some instruments? All right. I don't see where you're going with it, but we'll do it. Instruments, lights, and go down there with the 300. And die. This is the plan. I'm going down with lanterns. I'm going down with some instruments, and we're going to die at the hands of the Midianites. What was everything about up to this point? No, you need to do this. Now, here's how amazing God is. Here's how stunning God's patience and grace and mercy and kindness is. You could easily miss this as you work your way down through. You get to verse 12 of chapter 7. It's a little bit of a side story, and I can't get over how good God is. What has Gideon's hang up been the whole time? All right, listen. I'm going to do this. Wait right here by the oak tree. I'm going to go in. He's going to prepare some unleavened cakes. He's going to prepare the kid. He's going to get the broth. He's going to bring it out. Just wait right here. All right, put it on the rock, puts it on the rock, touches the staff, burns it up, disappears. Sign number one. All right, I need you to see this. Now, if you're really wanting me to do this, here's a fleece. Wet on the fleece, dry on the ground. Please don't be mad at me just this once. I'm going to put the fleece back out. Fleece dry, wet on the ground. He always needs a little reassurance, right? God doesn't ever put up with people who are imperfect. God never puts up with people who are uncertain. God expects perfection. God expects us to always be certain. Here's something stunning that God does. You're down to 300. I know you moved by night, but you moved by night. I know you're out here and you've done what I've asked of you. And we get to verse 12, and here's what it says. The Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seaside for multitude. Battle lines are drawn. They're back to wipe everybody out. Gideon's got how many people with him? 300. How many are down in the valley? Well, we can't even count. In verse 13, and when Gideon was come, as God told him, listen, this is pretty amazing. God says to Gideon, I want you to take Phurah, your servant. That's his armor bearer. Phurah is his servant next to him. He says, I want you to walk down. I want you to sneak down. Get right down next to the camp of the Midianites. Just go down there. Now, I mean, at this point, everything that God has requested of Gideon is strange. Take Phurah, your servant. I need you to have, because I know how you are. If you don't have a second set of ears that hears this, you're not going to believe it. So I want you to take Phurah, your servant. I want you to sneak down in the dark, which is your specialty, Gideon, and get down by the camp of the Midianites. And I want you to hide there, and I just want you to listen. Okay. Gideon takes Phurah, his servant. They slink down to the camp. Verse 13. And when Gideon was come, now he's close enough to the tents of the army of the Midianites that he can hear this. There was a man that told a dream unto his fellow, unto his friend. He had a dream. He's down there right at the edge of the camp of the Midianites. And he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian and came unto a tent and smote it that it fell and overturned it that the tent lay along. God, you brought me down here to hear this man's dream about a loaf of barley bread. Now, hold on. Did he ask for reassurance from God? Not at this point. God, assessing the situation, knowing his servant so intimately, says, I know you. Get down there and listen to this. Sneaks in, sitting with Phurah, his servant. I had a dream. What'd you dream? Cake of barley bread, rolled down the hill, hit a tent, tent went flat, laid along. Okay, now here's where it gets so cool. You get into verse 14. And his fellow answered and said, this dream is nothing else. Nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host. And it was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof that he worshipped and returned into the host of Israel and said, I'm pumped now. Arise, for the Lord hath delivered into our hands, into your hands, the host of Midian. Here's what I love about God's patience and grace and kindness and amazing mercy and long suffering to mold a man of God. Gideon didn't even ask for reassurance this time. I know you needed me to burn the stuff on the rock and do the stuff with the fleece. Come here, let me tell you something. Get down to the camp. Take for a, and listen to this. I had a dream. What was your dream? Loaf of barley bread. Here's where I, again, just go with me. We never get to be cool in God's plan. Even in the dream, you're a loaf of barley bread. It's not like I had a dream that this glinting spear fired out of the mountain down into a tent and shot through and the tents were festooned with guts. Oh, that's Gideon. No, I saw a loaf of barley bread. Yeah, that's Gideon. God's always the hero of these stories. His plan only makes sense to him, and no light ever really shines on us. Even in the dream, we're a loaf of barley bread. But a loaf of barley bread, nonetheless, that knocks a tent over. And as he's sitting there listening, here comes this Midianite soldier who says, I get your dream. Do you? Yeah. That is none other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Like, Gideon is so full of doubt that God's like, I got to make it really clear that this dream's about him. The son of Joash, that's me. My name's Gideon. The son of Joash, that's my dad, a man of Israel. Whoa! He's going to defeat the armies of Midian. And as soon as he heard it, he thinks, that's it. I got this. Walks back in and says, everybody get up. It's over for Midian. And down they go. And man, God does an amazing thing. They don't even have to swing swords. Why? Again, we don't get to be cool in God's plan. It's all about God. He's the hero of the story. Long story shorter, Midian falls. Gideon wins. Yay! Israel is freed. And then I wish that the story ended there. But there's a little bit of an unfortunate ending. If we could close the story out, it'd be great. But in verse 24 of chapter 8, Gideon says, I would desire a request of you that you would give me every man the earrings of his prey, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. He's going to make an imitation ephod. According to the scriptures, this is going to destroy his life. In fact, it seems that he assumes the role that God never intended for him. That's the high priest. And by verse 27 of chapter 8, Gideon made an ephod and put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither a whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. By verse 33, as soon as Gideon was dead, the children of Israel turned again and went a whoring after Balaam and Baal-Berith, their god, and they are back into punishment. Sometimes we believe that as soon as we crest that mountaintop and we come up with God's patience and we work our way through all of the doubt and uncertainty and accomplish His plan, that's when we really need the strength of God. That's our furnace where we're being tried. But Gideon didn't fail until after victory. I read this and I love it. God has two ways of trying men. One in the furnace of affliction. That's the first part of the story. The other in the refining pot of prosperity. That's the second. This is the much harder trial of the two. Affliction tends to humble and soften and subdue, but in prosperity, self-esteem, self-reliance, self-satisfaction, self-will, pride, and security are prone to spring up with a rank luxurious. The scriptures teach us the danger of prosperity and the inability of the human heart to drink a full cup of success without becoming intoxicated by it. Isn't that the truth? Gideon, think about it. You admitted you were from the least and the poorest. And you were uncertain the whole time. And God reassured and reassured and reassured. And he delivered with 300 against 135,000. And he did it with no weapons at all. It was all God all the way. And the moment you experience victory, you make an imitation ephod, put it in your city. All of Israel goes a-whoring after it. And as soon as you're dead and gone, because of what you did in the flesh and self-exaltation, they're immediately back in need of another rescuer. Two refining fires. Persecution and suffering and success. I think it's important for us to know when we're at our smallest, God's at His greatest. When we're at our weakest, He's at His strongest. We're never too small for God to use, but we can be too big. We can never, ever let our guard down. Listen, this man of God wasn't made in a moment, but he was undone in one. And that's a truth for all of us. Thank God for his patience. Pray for his continued strength. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes just a moment? That's an awful lot of story.